Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
A pro-Palestinian student movement makes its way to Canada, raising awareness about what's happening in Gaza and also tension. And universities say they've been put in a tough spot. Welcome to Your World Tonight on Sunday, April 28th. I'm Stephanie Skenderis, also on the podcast.
But I do think there will be a period in the next few years where we see a lot of family doctors' offices closing.
Family doctors in this country say tax changes have them feeling the financial crunch, unable to afford to fund their practices and their retirements at a time when it's already hard for patients to find care. And
we need monsters, and we need to name them, and we always have.
Why there's just so much apocalyptic content out there right now, and why that may not be a bad thing. An encampment has popped up on the McGill University campus in Montreal, emulating the massive protest movement that's happening across the United States. Students from both McGill and Concordia are protesting the war in Gaza, and they're calling on their schools to cut financial ties with Israel. Sarah Levitt has more.
A protester plays drums at the McGill encampment. Around him are signs proclaiming Free Gaza and All Eyes on Rafah. Inspired by students across campuses in the U.S., a few dozen protesters from both McGill and Concordia are calling for their universities to divest from Israel-connected funds. Among the protesters, Palestinians like Umania Tarek.
How can a university use students' money to fund a genocide? Like, that's just, I have no words for that. Like, that's insane.
As Tarek answers, though, she's interrupted.
No, I just have an opinion.
Okay, well,
I think you should be open to opinions because you're giving yours.
I absolutely agree, but we refuse to engage with Zionists.
Laura Nesri says she came to campus today as a Jewish person to see what the protest was about.
She doesn't engage with Zionists. What she's basically saying is that she doesn't want to hear the other side. So somewhere along the line, we're losing the opportunity for dialogue, and that's when it becomes dangerous.
Tensions are high, but not nearly as high as on U.S. campuses. As large numbers of students speak out against the ongoing Israel-Hamas war, universities responding in different ways. Police called in, hundreds arrested, many charged with trespassing, others with resisting arrest. Some schools like Columbia in New York City, where protests first began, closed campus access to students and staff only. Sahar Kamis is an associate professor at the University of Maryland. She says the protest movement has put universities in tough positions.
Universities really have this responsibility to strike this delicate balance between giving its own students the space and the place to have a peaceful protest and to make sure their voices and concerns are heard, and of course making sure that there is no hateful actions or violence of any sort.
At McGill, there has not yet been any intervention. The university says it asked tents to be removed, something protesters say they won't do until the school meets their demands. Meanwhile, in Gaza, a man with green spray paint writes, "Thank you, students," on a banner. Others, like this woman, stand in solidarity.
Us Gazan students go through pain, and we suffer every single day. And adding to the suffering that we witness every single day, we have to also work on finding anything to continue our future, to not lose what we learned.
And while those in Gaza can't go to school, others elsewhere use their campuses to speak out. Sarah Levitt, CBC News, Montreal.
Now, diplomatic efforts are ramping up for some sort of breakthrough in the war between Israel and Hamas and to address the humanitarian disaster in Gaza. A delegation from Hamas is heading to Cairo to discuss possible terms for a new ceasefire deal and hostage release. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State is heading to Saudi Arabia to get regional partners on board. Sasha Petrasik reports.
The aid Gaza desperately needs is starting to ramp up, even if reliable figures about how much is making it in are impossible to confirm. More trucks arriving through a new land crossing, preparations for a floating pier to be installed by the U.S. shortly. Israeli military spokesman Daniel Hagari insists Israel is meeting its commitment to Washington.
In the coming days, the amount of aid going into Gaza will continue to scale up even more. Food, water, medical supplies, shelter equipment, and other aid.
The White House says President Joe Biden pressed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on this issue again in a phone call today. Biden also got a commitment that Israel would not launch a ground incursion into Rafah in the south of Gaza without consulting with Washington, says National Security Advisor John Kirby.
We've had several staff talks with them. We intend to do that more. They've assured us that they won't go into Rafah.
That's critical, says the Pentagon Major General Patrick Ryder.
You have a scenario here where over a million people displaced. We don't support any type of operation unless civilian safety is taken into account.
For the U.S., the best way to avoid a Rafah operation would be for Israel and Hamas to come to a deal on a ceasefire, one that would see Israeli hostages released from Gaza. A Hamas delegation is on its way to Cairo for fresh talks Monday, though the two sides can't agree on whether a ceasefire should be temporary or permanent. U.S. diplomacy is also making the rounds of the Mideast, with Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Saudi Arabia today, heading for Israel on Tuesday, trying to get a ceasefire deal. Frank Lowenstein is an American special envoy for Mideast peace.
Hopefully some of the pressure we're working to build on them will help now get both sides over the line.
If successful, that could pause fighting, maybe even stop it within weeks or months. But it's not a permanent solution, says Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan, who wants to see more.
A real commitment to a two-state solution. That is a credible, irreversible path to a Palestinian state. That's the only reasonable and credible solution that guarantees us from not having to come back to this same situation.
Israel has not agreed to even start that discussion. Sasha Petrasik, CBC News, Washington.
And World Central Kitchen says it'll be resuming operations in Gaza on Monday. The aid organization had suspended operations earlier this month after seven of its workers were killed in an Israeli airstrike. Organizers say they'll be working with a Palestinian team to deliver food in Gaza. The Israel Defense Forces says it found serious breaches of procedure led to the strike and fired two senior officers. World Central Kitchen is demanding an independent investigation. Still ahead on the podcast, Russian landmines in Ukraine are killing and wounding hundreds of people. But cleaning them up is incredibly costly, and safety is still decades away. We'll tell you how people there are coping and about the work being done. That's coming up on Your World Tonight. The Biden administration has some new rules for American gun sellers. In the U.S., firearms can be sold at gun shows or online without making the buyer pass a background check. The regulations, which take effect in May, will close the so-called gun show loophole. As Tony Waterman tells us, it's taken decades of political wrangling.
Peyton Johnson is a second-generation gun dealer. Besides running a small shop called Gun Boss outside of San Antonio, he sets up tables at gun shows across Texas, about 30 of them a year.
Well, how many guns are you selling a year?
It depends on the year. With election coming up, it should be pretty high.
According to the U.S. Justice Department, Peyton is one of more than 80,000 firearms dealers with federal firearms licenses, or FFLs.
I've got 10.
That requires him to run a background check on gun buyers. But a new federal rule change expands the definition of who qualifies as a dealer to include anyone who sells a gun for a profit. It will impact unlicensed dealers, closing a loophole that has allowed them to sell guns without background checks at gun shows and online.
We have so many people that come through and ask us, are you guys an FFL? Do you guys do background checks? There's a reason they ask that question. This should stop those people from coming by.
Payton says up to 20% of the background checks he runs come back rejected. Under the rule change, more than 20,000 unlicensed dealers will also be required to perform background checks, keeping guns, officials say, out of the hands of dangerous people.
Convictions.
Karsten Anderson is a criminal justice professor at St. Edward's University in Austin.
And in some of the states that have imposed these background check laws, it looks like some preliminary research is that those communities are safer, about 10% safer in terms of gun violence.
But not everyone is convinced. Gun show organizer Darwin Bedeker says the rule change fails to address the underlying causes of gun violence.
Not one of these guns have jumped off a table, ran down the street, and shot somebody.
The battle over the gun show loophole goes back at least 25 years to the Columbine High School massacre. Two students killed 12 of their classmates and one teacher. Three of the four firearms used in the rampage were bought at a gun show by a friend without a background check. Then President Bill Clinton urged lawmakers to act.
If we don't do something about this gun show loophole, we're going to continue to have serious, serious problems.
Since then, there have been several bills introduced to close the gun show loophole. But those efforts have been thwarted by congressional Republicans and organizations like the National Rifle Association. They look poised to fight this regulation, too. In a statement, the NRA calls the rule change an attack on law-abiding gun owners and says it is already working to use all means available to stop what it calls this unlawful rule. One thing that could work in their favor is the conservative majority U.S. Supreme Court, which just 2 years ago ruled that the Constitution protects a person's right to carry a gun in public, opening a whole new era of gun ownership in America. Tony Waterman for CBC News, Austin, Texas.
2 years into Russia's invasion of Ukraine, about one-third of the country's landscape is now dotted with landmines. The explosive devices have already killed at least 400 people, while more than 1,000 others have been seriously wounded. As Briar Stewart reports, any effort to clear away the mines could take decades and cost tens of billions of dollars.
Andrei Nalezhaty leans on his crutches as he carefully walks down a road in the village of Dovhenke in eastern Ukraine. His left leg is in a plaster cast that runs up to his thigh. This is the first time he's been back to his family's rural property since February, when he, along with his father and cousin, came to see if it was possible to start preparing the field to plant a crop. They didn't make it far before the explosion. His father and cousin were killed. I think if an ambulance would have come quicker, then it would have been possible to save them, he said. In the hospital, the doctors said they would not have been able to save me if I got there half an hour later. He believes his family triggered a tripwire detonating a landmine. As he spoke to a freelance journalist working for CBC News at the site earlier this month, another landmine, which had already exploded, was visible in the grass, along with the fuse. They were left behind after the fight for this area southeast of Kharkiv and the eventual retreat by Russian forces.
But what we're seeing in Ukraine really is on a level that we haven't seen in decades.
Jasmine Dan is with the Halo Trust, a humanitarian organization that's been working to clear landmines in Ukraine since 2015. She's Canadian, but currently based in Mykolaiv in southern Ukraine.
Additionally, I think the Ukraine conflict has also shown us really widespread usage of landmines, something that previously I think a lot of people thought was going out of practice within modern militaries. So unfortunately, it's shown that this is still something that's very prevalent.
While the Halo Trust is working to clear Russian-laid minefields, there is evidence Ukraine has used landmines in the conflict too. An investigation by Human Rights Watch found that it appeared Ukraine scattered thousands of rocket-fired anti-personnel landmines in and around the eastern city of Izyum while it was occupied by Russia. The mines, which are often called petal or butterfly mines, are about 12 centimeters long and typically green or brown in color. It's that type of mine that Lydia Barova believes she stepped on last year while mushroom picking. The 70-year-old bounds around her garden, showing off the tomatoes and cucumbers she's growing, but she rolls up her pink track pants to show her prosthetic limb. After the blast, her right leg had to be amputated below the knee. Only Russia is to blame for the fact that they have caused this destruction, she said. It's estimated it will cost tens of billions of dollars to clean up the landmines and other explosives that contaminate a large swath of Ukraine. That work could take decades, which means for civilians, the risk will remain long after the soldiers are gone. Briar Stewart, CBC News, London.
To Morocco now, where a small but thriving Jewish community is observing Passover. There were once 250,000 Jews in Morocco. Now, only a small fraction remain after decades of emigration, mostly to Israel. While the war in Gaza has increased some tensions between Morocco and Israel, there is still a long-standing spirit of coexistence for people living in the North African nation. Freelance reporter Alexa Dvorsen brings us that story.
Not far from Jemaa al-Fana, the ancient marketplace of Marrakesh, is the Mela, the centuries-old Jewish quarter. That's where Jacky Kadosh was born in the 1950s. He laments the lack of Jewish visitors to Morocco since October 7th and longs for their return.
Only 1 year ago, we had here every Friday night more than 300 people coming to have a service. Now finish. Now we are less than 20.
The synagogue where Kadosh heads the city's Jewish community lies in a part of town that was off limits to Jews during the French conquest.
Because you know the story that the French people came in Morocco in 1912, and then...
During the Second World War, King Mohammed V defied the Nazi-allied Vichy regime of France and spared 250,000 Moroccan Jews from deportation to the death camps. Today, Kadosh praises his grandson, the current king, for maintaining formal ties with Israel despite the war in Gaza.
It's terrible, but the king, God bless him, never decided to close the accord with Israel. This makes me very happy.
Kadosh is referring to the Abraham Accords that Morocco and three other Arab nations signed with Israel nearly 4 years ago. Informal ties between Morocco and Israel had already been in place for decades.
You came through this gate. Then you have Jewish quarter that we call Malah.
In Fez, Morocco's oldest city, Farid works in the travel industry and doesn't want his real name used. While Israel's war in Gaza is deeply unpopular in Morocco, it's too loaded a subject for some to address openly.
This is hurting everybody. Communities shouldn't hate each other because of what happened. We deserve happiness, that's all.
Henri Cohen, a leading figure in Fez's Jewish community, looks back fondly on the friendly atmosphere between Jews and Muslims in his youth.
C'était super magnifique.
It was fantastic, he says. We lived together, studied together, we loved one another. He adds that many of his Muslim friends learned Hebrew and they're still in touch with him today. He has Palestinian friends too. That's one reason why he refuses to take sides in the war. But he does want to see a Palestinian state.
Bien sûr. Moi, le 7 octobre, au soir, j'ai eu deux appels.
The night of October 7th, Cohen got two phone calls from local authorities offering protection. But he's never needed it. We are well respected here, he says. But he's one of barely 30 Jews remaining in Fez, down from 22,000 in the 1960s. Most left for Israel in the decades after the state was founded, including Cohen's parents and some of his siblings. In Fez's Jewish quarter, I meet Karim, a 30-something local who, like Farid, doesn't want his real name used either. But he's eager to recount the close friendship between his Muslim grandparents and their Jewish neighbors as he shows people around.
Jewish people from Canada, Israel, America, they ask me, I want to see this house because my mother was sleeping here and my grandmother. So,
Jewish roots in Morocco date back more than two millennia. In doing what he loves, Karim helps revive a shared history largely unknown outside this country. He's deeply distressed by events just two time zones away.
I don't like Palestinian killing the Jew or the Jewish killing the Palestinian. I have no stone in my heart. Just I want to see peace in this world. We have to live together because we are human, madam.
Alexa Divorson, CBC News, Fez, Morocco.
These days, it can feel like everything is bad or negative or hard. And if you're a keen watcher of movies and TV, you may have noticed that reflected back. Fictional stories of world-ending diseases, countries torn apart by war, or robots rebelling against their human masters. Eli Glasner looked into why Armageddon is all the rage.
Practically every person I've met up here has tried to kill me.
I'm simply going to harvest your organs.
On the small and the big screen,
soon as DC falls, they'll turn on each other.
Audiences can't get enough of apocalyptic scenarios.
The collapse is so near.
Holy Moses.
Things haven't gotten a hell of a lot better since the first season of our show.
On the show, We're All Going to Die, Canadian actor and executive producer Jay Baruchel confronts his anxiety, exploring everything from killer bugs to out-of-control AI.
Like, I don't know if you're like a news junkie, but the past 4 or 5 years have been quite colorful and eventful.
It could be lights out in minutes.
We create a super virus.
Good Lord.
He says this kind of entertainment helps us confront our fears.
We need monsters, and we need to name them. And we always have.
I think we kind of like to swim in that dark space.
Right.
I think that humans naturally, we do like dark things.
And Civil War is a new movie about a shattered America at war. It was number one at the box office for 2 weeks in a row. No surprise to film critic Rachel Ho.
We're living in very divisive times, especially our friends down south. It's quite tense, I think is the best word for it, probably. So it makes sense that our entertainment is reflecting that reality.
Chris Begley is the author of The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. He says apocalyptic scenarios are on the rise for good reason.
It really is like resetting everything. You're getting rid of the baggage. You're able to start anew, or perhaps you're able to have this this ideal future that mirrors in some ways the things you wish would happen.
As for Jay Baruchel, after staring into the abyss, he's come to some surprising conclusions.
It's made me more of an optimist. We are prone to less diseases. We are more literate. We kill each other less than we ever have, which is crazy considering what a like garbage fire it is out there, right? Like, so as shitty as it is, and anecdotally especially, it is very shitty. This is the best it's ever been.
A silver lining to our apocalyptic obsessions. Eli Glasner, CBC News, Toronto.
Dans mon âme et dedans ma tête, il y avait autrefois un petit roi.
That's beloved Quebec singer Jean-Pierre Ferland. He made more than 30 albums, was named a Companion of the Order of Canada and Knight of the National Order of Quebec. He's in the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame. And today he's being remembered as a giant of francophone music. Ferland has died at the age of 89, of natural causes after being hospitalized earlier this year, according to his agent. He leaves behind songs like this one, his signature.
Une chance comme ça.
Une chance comme ça became a Quebec music classic. It brought nearly 20 artists together during 2020's isolation. And was performed alongside Celine Dion. Ferland's career began in broadcasting, working as a clerk for Radio Canada in the late 1950s, decades later, hosting two shows. But music was constant. His biggest album, his magnum opus, some have said, was 1970's Jean.
Tout ça pour une gonzesse.
C'était extraordinaire parce que c'était aussi bon que les Beatles, mais
Quebec Premier François Legault says it was as good as the Beatles, but it was in French. It was Quebecois. It was ours. He's offered a state funeral if Ferland's family wishes. We'll leave you with some more from Jean-Pierre Ferland on Your World Tonight. I'm Stephanie Skenderis. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.